And we're recording. And I'm delighted to have with me Brad Marshall, who's a pig farmer, a butcher, a charcutier, a food historian, a molecular biologist, a database programmer. He invented the Quassant diet and he coined the term low poof a pork. Welcome on again, Brad.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's been a little while, a couple years, right?
Couple of years, yeah. And I really enjoyed having you on the first time. I really appreciate you coming on again. The first time you were on, the episode was called The Quassant Diet. And that's something that you developed and wrote about on your blog, Fire in a Bottle. And you have also been selling what you call low poof a pork for some time. And maybe you could, we spoke before about how we could get into this, which is kind of a technical area. You know, you're a technical guy and you like to think about how different cellular mechanisms kind of cascade in the body and fit in with all the other ones, and what are the dominant ones in terms of metabolism, you know, how we get energy, how we feel subjectively energetic, overweight, normal weight, how our appetite is, how our mood is, etc. And so we said that maybe a good way into all of this might be to start with like what you recommend, or what you do yourself based on what you've studied and written about and done on your YouTube channel, and then go from there. So, you know, the Quassant diet, low poof of pork. You talk about pu'er tea a lot, the type of fermented tea, and low linoleic acid, low omega-6, particularly linoleic acid. So
Yeah.
why don't you talk around all that stuff?
Sure. And so let's start with the low linoleic acid, because I think that's really kind of the thread that ties a lot of these things together. I'm a big fan of, as you say, traditional diets and food history, and I think a lot about what the traditional diets of I live in upstate New York, as we were just talking about, and it's January and the light levels are very low. But people here, this is a dairying area traditionally, as is much of Europe, as is much of the world, right? And I study a lot the traditional diet of kind of France and upstate New York. Those are my kind of guideposts. And that diet was pretty low in polyunsaturated fat. The main fat would have been butter, dairy fat. The cow was the, when you live in a homestead economy, the dairy cow is always the center of the homestead. And that is, all sort of the entire ecology of the homestead sort of flows through the dairy cow, as well as, a lot of the food, because obviously all the milk and butter comes from the cow. And so butter is only about maybe 2% polyunsaturated fat, or actually less, probably, in a traditional grass-fed cow that wasn't fed grains. It's probably only something like 1.5% polyunsaturated fat. And interestingly, and dairy is also pretty low in monounsaturated fats. So butter is a quite saturated source of fat, and that was the traditional, that was the traditional fat. That certainly the US and Europe ate for, well, hundreds of years, thousands of years in Europe. And those societies were pretty lean. If you look back at people in New York, I was just looking at World Series photos, right? And so the World Series is a baseball game or a baseball series, for those of you who don't know, that happens in America. And the Yankees are a New York team, and they've been very good. So there's been a lot of World Series in Yankee Stadium, and so there's tons of photos that you can find in the old Yankee Stadium and all these baseball games. And it's amazing just to see, the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, And dress standards have changed. They all have a bowler cap, and they're all wearing a suit at the baseball game. But but beyond that, you also notice there's really no, you don't really see any obesity, and all these people were eating this very kind of traditional American diet, which was whole milk, butter, white bread, potatoes, pie. You know, apple pie was. It, the phrase American, it's as American as apple pie is real. Like every, you know, I think almost everyone ate pie, if you go back to the 1930s, say. And so you had what was really considered today a very rich, palatable diet. And what I like about the Yankee Stadium photos is that when these photos are taken from the field and you're looking at the front, you know, the front several rows in Yankee Stadium, these are not, you know, these are not farmers, right? These are banking executives and advertising executives, and they're, you know, by that time, the subways had all been built, the, you know, buildings had elevators, people took the cab to work. So this is not a particularly active population,
And
presumably.
they had
And
the means to feed themselves with however many calories they felt like.
right, exactly. And so I have this great USDA yearbook of agriculture from 1939, and they do a and they look at how much food people consumed in the 30s, and you know, it's a lot. And interestingly, the more money people had, the more food they bought. Period. And so in the wealthiest Americans in the 1930s, presumably these are the people in the front row at Yankee Stadium, you know, their average, according to the USDA, the average number of calories used by the household, it doesn't necessarily mean eaten. They probably wasted some, but that was a very frugal generation. They didn't like to waste. And it was like 4,500 calories per adult male in East Coast cities was the amount of calories that families went through, you know, according to the USDA in, I think, 1939. And so you see this, so what you see is this population that's very lean, and you know, you can look at, you can make the same argument about you know, places in France, although it's obviously a little different what was happening in Europe then. Anyway, the point is you see this diet and it's very low in polyunsaturated fat. It's a very rich diet, but yet you don't see a lot of obesity. And it's not that people ate meat. They ate pork and beef. They ate white flour. They ate potato. You know, it's not like it was high carb or low carb, or it certainly wasn't low calorie, and it was very rich, and they didn't avoid sugar. You know, they were eating lots of sugar. And they were very lean. And so that's kind of the historical basis. And then, sure. And so then over the course of the century, the main food that was added to that diet was soybean oil. And so soybean oil went from being essentially, I mean, we didn't even really grow soybeans in the US in the year 1900. They had been introduced. There was a few curiosity articles about them in agricultural magazines, but it was over the course of the, you know, by the 1930s and 1940s, they had realized that the protein in the soybeans were really good to grow animals on. Plus, soybeans have estrogenic hormones, and that made the pigs and the chickens grow faster. So they realized, oh, these soybeans are great for growing livestock, and then, you know, they had this waste product, which was the soybean oil. And so what are we going to do with it? And they, you know, they started feeding it to people, right? And so, and then over the century, it worked its way into potato chips and crackers and all of the things. And it's a funny thing because I think that, so obviously these polyunsat, so poly, so vegetable oils have a lot of polyunsaturated fats, and the polyunsaturated fats have a very, I don't want to say this wrong, a very high melting point, which means they're liquid at room temperature. They're liquid in the refrigerator. So if you, so they stay liquid at very low temperatures. And there was a lot of research around this in the 1950s and 60s because the idea that saturated fat caused heart disease, right, was trending. And they thought that these polyunsaturated fats, they essentially were thinking about these saturated fats on a fairly simple, like a, I call it the sink drain analogy, but the idea that, saturated fats clog your sink drain, and liquid oils are less likely to do that because they don't become a solid at the temperature that you're running things down the drain. And I think that was sort of how they were thinking about heart disease at the time, is that, oh, these hard fats clog your arteries and these liquid ones don't. And so anyway,
A perfect
and so
example
there
of one
was.
of these just so stories that we tell. Like, it seems to make sense intuitively, but it's just made up.
Yeah, it's just kind of made up, right? Exactly. And so anyways, but because of that, there was a lot of research done on the effects of these polyunsaturated fats because they weren't really they had never been consumed on a wide basis yet, right? And these guys were actively telling people, you should eat more of these, this because there really was a wave of heart disease happening at the time, and they thought this was the answer, was to, was to desaturate the fats. And they did a lot of studies, and there's a funny thing that happens with vegetable oils in short-term feeding studies, where if you feed people a meal of vegetable oil or a meal of saturated fat, in the short term, and a couple hours later, you go, oh, the people who ate the vegetable oil are actually burning more fat. That's true, right? And so if you eat soybean oil, if you eat like soybean oil on your mashed potatoes, 2 hours later, you'll be burning more fat than if you ate saturated fat with your mashed potatoes. And so people looked at that and they were like, oh, this is great. These, we burn these polyunsaturated fats faster than we burn saturated fats. And if we eat them with potatoes, that means we burn more fat. And this is great because we want to burn fat, right? And that's all true. And this has been repeated many, many times. But the problem with that is that, in fact, if you eat potatoes with fat, as the traditional American and French diets did, the correct thing to do is to use the carbohydrates first and then burn the oil, right? And so this kind of short-term observation that seemed to a lot of people like a really good thing, I think is actually a very dangerous thing. I think that in a mixed diet, if you, like I say, if you eat, starch with fat, the correct thing to do is to burn the starch first. And that is how, and that's what happens if you eat bread and butter. But the opposite happens if you eat bread and oil. And so what happens is the carbohydrates, if you're eating soybean oil, sure, if you're eating soybean oil on bread, what should happen is you have the surge of insulin, the starch is broken down into glucose. The glucose comes into your cells, you burn that. Once that's gone, then you switch back to burning fat. With vegetable oils, what happens is you burn the oil first. And what that does is it increases the amount of kind of acetyl-CoA in the cells, and I apologize, we're going to get a little bit technical here. So that increases the amount of things like NADH and acetyl-CoA in the cells, and that actually inhibits something called pyruvate dehydrogenase, which is kind of the limiting enzyme that allows you to burn carbohydrates as fuel.
Yes,
And
and
so
for people who are thinking, okay, there's a red flag, all of the names of these molecules, I would suggest that if people really want to dig in, read Brad's blog, but also if you want to go right from the start like I did, then go over to the Hyperlipid blog and read the protons thread, which is like 40 or 50 posts or something, where it really starts about how mitochondria work, the history of it, and then hearing about these molecules isn't as scary because you know that it's like a cast of characters in a play somehow. You know, we were talking before about how over the course of a billion years, where, you know, mitochondria sprung up at some point along that timeline, you know, doing various different new things, evolution's tried so much. You know, to the first approximation, evolution's tried everything in a billion years. So you're going to have all of these molecules doing 5 or 10 things in different processes, and you just have to sort of shine a little torchlight on wherever you can. And so I wouldn't feel, if you're listening to this, that you need to worry too much about remembering various different molecular names and so on. It's but they interact in a very specific way with mitochondria, and then you end up with very specific results. And you've really been finding scientific papers that show these results, right?
Yeah. And so there's one that I really like. And so I'm just real quick, I'll explain what pyruvate dehydrogenase is. So when you burn glucose, it gets turned into pyruvate, and then that happens in the cytosol of the cell. And it's the pyruvate that gets transported into the mitochondria. And so people have probably heard of glycolysis. So the glucose comes into the cell, glycolysis happens in the cytoplasm that converts it to two molecules of pyruvate. The pyruvate goes into the cell and into the mitochondria, and it gets converted to acetyl-CoA, and then it gets burned in the Krebs cycle or the TCA cycle. And most of the energy released from burning glucose happens in that Krebs cycle or the TCA cycle. And so everything up to pyruvate doesn't provide much energy from glucose. Then pyruvate dehydrogenase is the limiting thing that converts it to acetyl-CoA so that it can go into the Krebs cycle so that we can actually burn glucose, right? And if pyruvate dehydrogenase is not functioning, then we really can't get much energy by burning glucose or by burning starch. And what happens is it gets redirected into de novo lipogenesis, which just means making new fat. And so, right. So when we eat, when you eat any carbohydrates, as they come in, you essentially have a choice. Do you want to burn it and get ATP and energy from it? Or do you want to convert it from fat? And a key limiting enzyme in making that decision is pyruvate dehydrogenase. And so so there was a really cool study that was done, and I think it was done in like the 90s. This guy took I don't know why it's complaining about the battery. It's plugged in. Anyway, so this guy took young college athletes and he gave them either and they were riding these stationary bikes, and he gave them either I believe it was sunflower oil or heavy cream in some kind of like shake. And so basically they were there for like 4 hours, and one group had all this vegetable oil and the other group ate all this cream. And then they had them ride these stationary bikes just for like a minute. And then they took a muscle biopsy, and they tested whether or not they had active pyruvate dehydrogenase, which is the thing that lets you burn glucose rather than converting it into fat. And so what happened was the people who were given the sunflower oil, they did not activate pyruvate dehydrogenase in response to the cycling, and the people who ate the cream did. And so vegetable oil has this very fundamental characteristic that it sort of inhibits your ability to burn starch as, you know, oxidatively, to burn it as fuel to make ATP. It prefers to shunt your carbohydrates into fat making. And that all happens. I have a new YouTube channel, and I have a video on there called The Onion of Life. And I actually think that's sort of how I have come to think about things. And it's sort of like you say, we have this billion years of evolution, and a lot of the processes that happen in a cell are far more ancient than the newer things that have kind of been layered on top of it, right? And that's the onion analogy, is that we started with this kind of central core of biology, and the things that were controlling the oldest cells were things like the ratio of NAD plus to NADH. NAD is an electric carrier. Most of biology is just electrons moving around. And NAD plus, when it has electrons, it becomes NADH. And when it loses the electrons, it's NAD plus. And so that ratio kind of tells the cells how much energy there is, and the cell is making decisions based on that ratio. And then as we move outside and we start talking about things like pyruvate dehydrogenase and so many things, AMP kinase and mTOR, and all of these things are, in different ways, they're just manipulating the NAD plus to NADH ratio, but they're also reading the NAD plus ratio, and they're acting accordingly. And so the ratio of NADH to NAD plus, it turns out, is this incredibly important controller of what each cell decides to do. And what happens with when these cyclists are eating the sunflower oil is that the polyunsaturated fat, like I say, they are transported faster, and they're transported into the mitochondria faster, and they essentially are unleashing a lot of acetyl-CoA, and that acetyl-CoA is being very rapidly turned by the TCA cycle into NADH. And the NADH and the acetyl-CoA themselves inhibit pyruvate dehydrogenase. And so this is a very old, right? We have this regulatory mechanism where the cells will either burn fat or they'll burn carbohydrates. And when they're burning one, they kind of inhibit the burning of the other. And so the vegetable oils kind of like jump up in line, and they demand to be burned first. And the fact that they're being burned is inhibiting the burning of the of the glucose. And I'm flaking on, there's a that process of fat inhibiting carbohydrate burning, and the other way around has a name, and I'm forgetting it. Do you know what I mean? Off the top of my head, it's the Randall cycle. That's what it's called. So if you look up the Randall cycle, you can see there's just a couple key kind of enzymes and key steps that control whether cells are burning glucose or fat. And essentially, the vegetable oils are kind of, they're sort of they're overturning the Randall cycle, or they're controlling the Randall cycle in a way that I would argue is inappropriate, in response to a mixed meal, right? And that's a long way of saying that. But that initial observation that when you eat starch with fat, you should burn the starch first. And when you eat the starch with vegetable oil, that doesn't happen, because the vegetable oil overwhelms the Randall cycle. And that is a, I just think, a really key and fundamental point that I don't hear a lot of people talking about. But when I look at it in my world and think about NAD plus and NADH, I think that's a really key study and a really key observation.
Yeah, and it's a great starting point to talk about. You're sort of beyond the idea that carbs are somehow inherently damaging. There's like a whole swathe of the sort of nutrition Twitter who would say carbs have caused so much damage, and then you really don't have to look very deeply to see that it can't be the carbs per se. I would argue that something in gluten or gluten grains, has maybe got worse over the last 100 years, but maybe not. And it's, there's certainly something, it seems to me, interacting between gluten and these kind of vegetable oils with linoleic acid in them as well, that seem to have, you know, have increased autoimmune diseases. But you know, a lot of the world eat a lot of wheat, and they don't have the same dreadful health issues that populations who eat a lot of linoleic acid eat. And then you only have to see, you know, people like the Japanese up until, you know, 40 years ago or something, who are eating like 80% of their diet in white rice, and they were the picture of health, 80% of the calories, I should say. So it's not the carbs per se. And what you're talking about really goes beyond that and starts looking at, so what is it and why? And I think that's a great human experiment, because a lot of people talk about mouse experiments and they get attacked for that. But the onion, as you describe it, allows for that, because some of these processes are so ancient that the kind of experiments you can do on mice are perfectly appropriate.
Yeah, and so the, you know, right, the NAD plus, NAD plus and NADH were carrying electrons, presumably in the first cell from, what, 3.2 billion years ago, I think. So we have 3.2 billion years of the NAD plus to NADH ratio being the kind of like fundamental, it's kind of like, is the gas tank full? You know, if you have a lot of NADH, there's a lot of energy right now, and that can be a problem if there's too much energy.
Yeah, because you talk about the cell telling the outside of the cell this information, but of course, if you look at that over the whole body, you get this systemic effect. You know, it really, these effects are all over the body at once, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's different in all tissues, but it's all, you know, it's all communicating. And you know, and a lot of this, I think the fundamental processes are always the same. You know, if you talk about mouse versus human experiments, I think that when you're burning fat, it does push the NADH to NAD plus ratio higher than it does if you're burning carbohydrates in general. And that is, but then I think what happens is a mouse, you know, I think if it is like, we're all sort of mammals, right? But like, if you go into the control panel and you just like, you know, it's like, if you go into the control panel and you start with a horse and you like tweak a few settings, you make the legs longer and the neck longer. Now it's a giraffe, right? And so, but essentially the program that we're running is the same, right? And it, and so we have all the same transport enzymes, and so a lot of it, I think, has to do, like, so, okay, so maybe mice are, and I believe that they are, more prone to become overweight if you feed them a high fat diet, like maybe 45% of calories is fat. In the lab, you can pretty reliably fatten up a mouse, and that's probably due to the fact that, like, the dynamics of the way that the fat is absorbed and how fast it's transported and how fast the enzymes work and how fast it goes into the mitochondria. You know, what we really want at the end of the day, what we really want is just to burn all of our fuel cleanly, right? And what happens is NADH and NAD plus are really just, it's another way of looking at oxygen, right? So in our systems, we're eating, you know, we're essentially eating hydrocarbons. It's not unlike what happens in your car, which is why I make that analogy. We're eating hydrocarbons, you know, fat and starch are made of hydrogen and carbon, just like the gasoline that you put in your car, right? And then in your car, you mix the gas with a certain amount of air, which has oxygen in it. And it burns, and that's what makes the energy. And if you don't have enough oxygen, that's when you see, you know, black smoke coming out of the tailpipe. You see that unburnt fuel. And the body's no different. The mitochondria is doing the same thing as the spark plugs in your car is doing. It's taking You know, it's taking in these hydrocarbon fuels and it's releasing and it's burning, it's combining it with oxygen, right? And it's releasing H2O and CO2. And the question is, do you have enough oxygen to completely burn the fuel? And the NAD plus and the NADH are really just oxygen, because the thing that is directly oxidizing the food is NAD plus. And so you need a bunch of NAD plus to make sure that the food is fully oxidized or fully burned, so you don't have these extra waste products, because the extra waste products are the things that wind up back in your bloodstream, and they kind of bog everything down.
So with that in mind, with the oxidation and the waste process, given different types of meals in mind, it makes me think about how we spoke about before the problem with calories in, calories out. And thinking back to your first point about the Yankees fans who are all slim, who according to the USDA, were eating richly as much as 4,500 calories a day per adult male. Why didn't they store that as fat? What's going on there? Why is this, if you've got like an energy balance, energy in equals energy out, calories in, calories out, why does eating you know, vegetable oils cause the energy out to actually go down, and other types of diets, what types of diets make the energy out go up?
Yeah, and so that is right. So that's a really interesting question, and that harkens back to, like you said at the beginning, sort of the protons threat and hyperlipid, and what I talk about in my blog. And so it turns out that we make these things called free radicals or reactive oxygen species. It's really superoxide. Superoxide is an oxygen molecule that has grabbed an extra electron. And so people are scared of free radicals. They think that they cause cellular damage, and they can if they build up. And so it's a little bit of a scary topic, but what happens is, in fact, when you look at the way that that superoxide, there's something called superoxide dismutase, which makes it into hydrogen peroxide, which we're all familiar with, right? Because you can get it in the brown bottle at the drugstore. And so all of our cells make this hydrogen peroxide. And the way that we get rid of the hydrogen peroxide, people may have heard of glutathione. We have this antioxidant system baked into us, the glutathione system. And the glutathione converts the hydrogen peroxide back harmlessly to water. And the sort of amazing part about this system is that it uses NADPH to and the enzyme called glutathione reductase to eliminate the hydrogen peroxide, and that NADPH becomes NADP plus, and there's another thing called NNT which converts it back to NAD plus. And so as we make this superoxide in the mitochondria, we have these enzyme systems that get rid of it. And the whole time that they're doing that, they're returning NAD plus. And so if it's done in the right context, the creation of superoxide and these reactive oxygen species is actually increasing the amount of oxygen burned. It's helping us to burn the food cleanly. And so saturated fats, due to the way that the mitochondria is set up, they create more of these of the superoxide than do unsaturated fats. And so monounsaturated fats like an olive oil make significantly less superoxide, and polyunsaturated fat probably even a little bit less than the monounsaturated fat in olive oil. And so all of these unsaturated fats are essentially, because they're not creating superoxide, because they're not recycling NAD plus, they don't burn as cleanly. And so then you have a buildup of NADH, and we're gonna, and I'll take it even back to carbohydrate metabolism. And this is something that I've added on to the hyperlipid protons ideas in the last year, is that the other things in the mitochondria, and one of the other major things in the mitochondria that creates superoxide as it does its job, is pyruvate dehydrogenase, right? So we've already talked about that. That's the enzyme that is the limiting factor of glucose burning, right? And so that scenario that I was talking about, where you're eating starch with vegetable oil versus starch with butter, right? So in the case that you're eating starch with butter, the pyruvate is being converted to acetyl-CoA first, and that's generating reactive oxygen species. That's giving you NAD plus back, right? And that's all good. And you're burning the starch from that bread. And then as the glucose levels drop, then the fats from the butter can come in and be burned, and they're saturated. So they're making superoxide and they're returning NAD plus, and that process can kind of happen cleanly and everything burns. But in the case of the vegetable oil gets priority for burning. And that does two things. One is the vegetable oil itself, as it's being burned, doesn't create as much superoxide, so you're not getting as much NAD plus back. But that also means that pyruvate dehydrogenase becomes inhibited. And pyruvate dehydrogenase is the other major source of superoxide production. And so you're doubling up on the problem, because not only do the vegetable oils not create as much superoxide as they burn, but they're preventing pyruvate from being burned oxidatively, and that's also preventing the superoxide formation, and that's also preventing the regeneration of NAD plus. And NAD plus essentially controls your metabolic rate. The TCA cycle or the Krebs cycle, all of our foods get made into acetyl-CoA, and it takes 3 NAD plus to burn an acetyl-CoA molecule. And so, you know, quite simply stated, the more NAD plus there is, the faster the TCA cycle goes. And the faster you burn your calories, the more cleanly, and you have a good metabolic rate.
So is it reasonable to say that your recommendations are based on increasing NAD plus?
Ultimately, yes. That is the common denominator, is replacing that NAD plus. I think the things that build up in the mitochondria that really bog down your metabolism and lead to obesity and lead to heart disease and cancer and a lot of these things are, it's essentially a buildup of NAD plus, but that also, or sorry, let me say that again. It's a buildup of NADH. So you have too much NADH and not enough NAD plus. And then what happens is that sort of starts this downward spiral, because when that happens, the TCA cycle slows down and acetyl-CoA levels build up. And if there's not enough NAD plus, there's these enzymes called sirtuins, and they need the NAD plus to do their job. But what the acetyl groups do is they actually gum up mitochondrial enzymes, and the sirtuin enzymes remove the acetyl groups from those mitochondrial enzymes. So what starts to happen is that NADH gets too high and NAD plus gets too low, then your mitochondrial enzymes, they get acetylated and they get turned off. And that acetylation is just simply caused by there's not enough NAD plus. The citric acid cycle slows down. The citric acid cycle is the thing that burns the acetyl-CoA. So acetyl-CoA levels rise, and that acetyl-CoA is those acetyl groups. And this doesn't even require an enzyme. It seems like this is a spontaneous process. As the acetyl groups rise, they will just simply stick to your mitochondrial enzymes and turn them off, and your metabolic rate drops. And since NAD plus is limited, the enzymes SIRT1 and SIRT3, whose job is to take those acetyl groups back off, they can only do their job if there's enough NAD plus. And the lack of NAD plus is why the acetyl groups kind of built up in the first place. And so when that NADH to NAD plus ratio gets out of whack, your metabolic rate really bogs down. And there's a lot of experiments that I've shown on the blog that can, you know, that shows that really that it really is that ratio that is incredibly crucial to sort of how much, how many how many calories per kilogram of lean mass that you burn in an hour. I'm not even doing anything. If you're just sitting on the couch, you know, if your mitochondrial enzymes aren't acetylated, you're going to burn a lot more calories than if they are. And so over the course of 24 hours, of course, that really builds up. And I think explains a lot of what's causing the obesity, you know, and it's not necessarily huge numbers, but I think that it's like, yeah, I mean, maybe it's 200 calories a day though. And you know, and you don't have to eat less or move more or do anything. It's just an extra 200 calories out the door every day because you're not, you know, because your enzymes are functioning the way they should.
And it seems to act at all ends, doesn't it? Because you've got, you know, things like effect on leptin, one of the hormones that controls hunger, and, you know, this AMP kinase that you've spoken about before as well, where, you know, it's not just that you sort of downregulate metabolism so that you probably feel a bit colder, you probably feel a bit more lethargic. It's that if you do the opposite and you minimize your linoleic acid, you drink your poor tea, etc., then, you know, your hunger is actually lower, but your metabolic rate's higher. So you find yourself in moving in the opposite direction.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And there's a ton of these feedback loops in the body, and they all seem to build on each other, you know, and that's the thing I've noticed is researching all these papers. It's like every time you start to see, you're like, oh, well, that happens. And, you know, it's like NADH builds up. Oh, but then you've got acetyl-CoA and the sirtuins aren't working. And then things start to get acetylated. And then, oh, for this other reason, because that happened, right, now your appetite is dysregulated. And like you say, yeah, leptin goes up. And so these things happen in the, you know, obviously the reason I think that these things are all happening in this seemingly very coordinated fashion, right? Like it's not by chance that this thing leads to that thing, leads to this thing, leads to that thing, leads to that thing, leads to obesity. It's probably part of an evolutionary strategy. You know, and I talk a lot in my blog about torpor, which is the idea that, hold on one second. Something is, let me grab, if you want to, kill a little time. I think that my charger isn't working. I'll be right back. I got another one right in the other room. Right. So anyway, what I was saying is that, you know, when you see this very coordinated response that looks like everything is leading towards obesity, that is probably part of an evolutionary strategy. And so on my blog, I talk a lot about torpor, which is the idea that mammals, have these kind of inbuilt sensors, and they, what those sensors are looking at are things like, is winter coming? Or in some cases, is the dry season coming? And they're trying to integrate all these environmental signals and say like, okay, it seems like winter's coming. We need to fatten up, right? And so—
And slow down, and so, ultimately.
What's that?
Fatten up, then slow down.
Fatten up and slow down, ultimately, right? And if you look at how these systems work, a lot of what they're doing, maybe 85% of what they're doing, is just manipulating the NADH to NAD plus ratio, like in the liver and in the adipose tissue, to favor fat storage, right? it's more complex. It's very complicated how they do it, and you can spend days and weeks, trying to track down every gene that they're changing and what they're upregulating. But at the end of the day, they're just, if we go back to that idea of the onion, they're mostly just manipulating that fundamental ratio. And so, I put forward this. This is my theory. As far as I know, no one has studied this, but my thought is this thing called the aryl hydrocarbon receptor, which I've been talking a lot of lately on my videos, is the sort of fundamental controller of torpor, this kind of alternate metabolic state that favors fat storage. And there's a lot of evidence that it is increased in obesity, and in diabetes, and there's a lot of evidence that it's increased in hibernating animals as well. And it's changing all these enzymes that are, so one of them, for instance, is this thing called PARP, and obese people make a lot more PARP, and PARP is a DNA repair enzyme. So you think, oh, well, that sounds good. We need DNA repair, right? That sounds important. Except that what happens is, we only need as much of it as we need. And the enzyme PARP uses NAD plus as fuel, basically. And so PARP takes NAD plus and it breaks it into two molecules. And one of those is I'm spacing on the name, nicotinamide. Yeah, it's just called nicotinamide. And so then so every time the PARP does its thing, it's so in metabolism, NAD plus gets an electron and it's converted to NADH, but the NADH can rapidly give the electron to up at the mitochondrial electron transport chain, and it just comes back to NAD plus. PARP actually takes NAD plus and it breaks it in half, and it makes it a nicotinamide, and then the nicotinamide has to get recycled. There is a way to convert the nicotinamide back to NAD plus, and also, by the way, niacin, which is vitamin B3, 2, I forget which one is which. Niacin is essentially where NAD plus comes from, and ultimately. And the other thing that the aryl hydrocarbon receptor does is it downregulates something called NAMPT, which is the enzyme that converts that nicotinamide back to NAD plus. And so this AHR is putting this kind of twofold hit on NAD levels. It makes this enzyme that converts it to nicotinamide, and then it reduces the enzyme that salvages nicotinamide and converts it back to NAD plus. And so it's really just dragging down NAD plus levels, and that leads to obesity pretty regularly and
And lower
dramatically.
metabolism.
Lower metabolic rate, exactly.
And so, I'm thinking more and more about mental health. And if we think about the mental acuity of a hibernating bear,
Yeah.
you might characterize that as torpid or
Yeah.
slow. What do you think about these mechanisms in the brain, just in terms of the energy availability, even for the
Yeah,
brain?
I mean, so I'm not an expert on mental health, but there are so one of the things that you see is that so the one of the main endogenous, meaning it doesn't come from your diet, it's something that you make, things that activates the aryl hydrocarbon receptor, and initiates torpor, and you see that it rises both in obese humans and in animals approaching hibernation, and then goes even higher while they're in hibernation, is this thing called kynurenine. So kynurenine is a tryptophan metabolite, and interestingly, kynurenine is you know, things like serotonin and melatonin. And serotonin is obviously important to mental health. That's also another tryptophan metabolite. And so, you see a lot of there's a lot of action in this kind of tryptophan pathway that is seems crucial metabolically, but also is obviously very important to mental health. And something I've recently become very interested in is there are a couple of drugs for schizophrenia, and they're secondary drugs. So there's sort of the first line treatments of schizophrenia. But for people who are not helped by those first line drugs, they give them drugs like clozapine. And I can't remember the name of the second one, but clozapine is very interesting. It affects, it definitely is affecting tryptophan metabolism, and that's probably how it's helping with, schizophrenic symptoms. But it also is an activator of the ERA hydrocarbon receptor. Probably the way it works is it probably looks like a molecule in the tryptophan metabolism pathway. And so it's probably kind of either blocking some of those enzymes. And people who are given clozapine have dramatic weight gain. And not only do they have dramatic weight gain, it causes type 2 diabetes. And so in some of these studies, at the beginning of the study, 0% of the population will have type 2 diabetes. Within 5 years, sometimes as much as 40% of the people have developed type 2 diabetes.
And if you think about the rates of diagnosis for type 2 diabetes, when they cross the line into their, their blood glucose response being, frankly, type 2 diabetic, if you think 40% are, then likely another 40, perhaps, are what you might call pre-diabetic.
Yeah.
At least.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. But like, but also when you think about diabetes, it's like diabetes is something that happens, over your lifetime, and you might be pre-diabetic for 20 years before you become diabetic. The rate at which the diabetes progresses on this clozapine is it's unbelievable and dramatic. And so, so to me, it's a very interesting demonstration that these tryptophan pathways and diabetes and obesity are really all kind of, tied at the hip or whatever. I don't think that's how that phrase goes, but it's been very interesting to me, and that is just been a recent fun area. I mean, it's not really a fun area of research. It's kind of depressing, actually, but it is a very interesting demonstration of those links, right, between whatever is happening with tryptophan and serotonin and kynurenine and obesity. And because the levels of kynurenine in, I think I've seen that kynurenine is often higher in mental health disorders, but I'm not 100% sure that's how it works. I don't know if that's something you've looked at all.
No, I would need to investigate that.
Yeah.
I know that there's certain metabolites which seem to be elevated in certain conditions. And, many of these have been tied to type 2 diabetes as well, and insulin pathological insulin resistance.
Yeah, sure.
Cynthia Calkin's paper talking about treating insulin resistance with metformin, where they studied it on humans.
Right. Well, so that's very interesting. And so metformin is one that, so there was a paper that came out. I mean, I guess this has been sort of known for a long time, but there's a paper that came out fairly recently showing that metformin pretty dramatically downregulates The aryl hydrocarbon receptor, the thing that I've been talking about, you know, is triggering a lot of these things. And it so the AHR has this positive feedback loop where it increases this enzyme called IDO, and IDO converts tryptophan to kynurenine, but then the kynurenine activates the aryl hydrocarbon receptor, and that makes more IDO, which makes more kynurenine, which makes more AHR, right? And so you have this positive feedback loop. And one of the things that they have done with the people who have to take this clozapine for schizophrenia symptoms is they give them metformin with the clozapine. And so the metformin prevents a lot of the weight loss and prevents a lot of the type 2 diabetes that's caused by the clozapine. Interestingly. And so, you know, it's all kind of right there, right? Yeah, you see the aryl hydrocarbon receptor and the kynurenine and the metformin and the clozapine and the mental disease. And interestingly, it does that without affecting, however, the effectiveness of the clozapine on the schizophrenia symptoms. And so,
which presumably is something to do with the tryptophan rather than, say, the negative metabolic effects, which may actually make things worse in other ways, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, so it seems like in the studies that they've done with the clozapine on tryptophan metabolism, the clozapine does a good job of actually returning tryptophan metabolites kind of back to normal, kind of back to like baseline people that don't have schizophrenia. So it seems like that is probably how it works, is by adjusting tryptophan metabolism. But then I think the problem with clozapine is the way that it does that is probably by mimicking a tryptophan metabolite, and it itself is activating the aryl hydrocarbon receptor in these other systems that are initiating torpor. And for some reason, the metformin is, you know, is drawing down the expression of the aryl hydrocarbon receptor and sort of taking that out of the loop. Seems to be how, maybe, perhaps how it all works. I mean, there's a lot of guesswork there, but.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it is guesswork. For practicing psychiatrists, you know, Georgia Yead was talking in the last podcast episode about how she can prescribe drugs judiciously and advisedly, and, you know, after conversations with patients. And, you know, really, she doesn't know how they're going to affect the patient until they try it. And there'll be a cocktail of results. And sometimes, like you say, you have to have a cocktail of drugs to counteract. You end up being like the old lady who swallowed the fly, covering up one pathway from the last drug with another one from the new one. And, you know, I think about 5-HTP for what you're talking about. A lot of people take 5-HTP as a supplement, which is an amino acid with a T standing for tryptophan, precursor to serotonin, and people feel better on, you know, whether sometimes for anxiety, sometimes for low mood. Tryptophan is central to these in some way, seemingly.
Yeah, well, and I think that I think perhaps the reason for that is simply the fact that tryptophan, you know, tryptophan as an amino acid has this large ring structure that most amino acids don't have. And, you know, I wonder if that is the reason for tryptophan's sort of centrality to these things, is due to the fact that it's this aryl molecule, as they call it, which just means has a ring. I think it's easier to act in kind of signaling pathways because that large planar ring structure is easy for enzymes to kind of recognize or receptors to recognize. I mean, there a hydrocarbon receptor does, but also we have these tryptophan receptors and in the brain, and you know, I think it may just be a basic, like a three-dimensional thing is why the tryptophan is so important. Because at first you're like, why? Yeah, you're like, why is this tryptophan such a big deal? But then it all kind of Yeah, it starts to make sense. It'd
It's
be
so
very
interesting,
hard.
isn't it? How like it, on some level we are made up of lots of little machines, and that sometimes it's about geometry of machinery parts.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And so if people were to think about how to approach their metabolic health, would it be fair to say aggressively limit linoleic acid in the diet, however you can, and drink poor tea and things should be fine, or is that unfair?
Yeah, I mean, well, so I mean, I think if your goal is, I talk about weight loss. I think weight loss is a difficult goal, right? If what I would like to see, what I'd like to figure out is in people who are essentially broken, and what I mean by broken is they have an inability to properly utilize carbohydrates, right? Really what I mean is, the pyruvate dehydrogenase, right? You have too much NADH, pyruvate dehydrogenase isn't working.
They're not like the Yankees fans anymore.
They're not like the Yankees fans anymore, right? And so, and the question is there a way to put that back? And because I feel like if you could become those Yankees fans again, if you can become someone who can, wake up and eat toast for breakfast and mashed potatoes for dinner, and you can burn those and run those through pyruvate dehydrogenase, then that really, I think, is the art of kind of metabolic flexibility, right? And like I say, those Yankees fans were also eating, they were eating butter and whole milk and pork chops. And so I don't think that, I think there is a way to be able to eat a mixed diet of containing both fat and carbohydrates as a human being, and to have a good metabolic rate and to be lean and healthy. And I think we've gone down a bad road, and the question is, how do we put that back, obviously. And so I focus a lot on, well, the poor tea is sort of magic. I've been selling this poor tea extract on my blog, which is the tea of Brownin, which seems to be the thing that gives it its the potent part of the poor tea that makes the difference. And I've been questioning for months, how does it work? And I don't really know, but everything, what all the papers are showing is that everything that, like the arachidrocarbon receptor, the thing that's initiating this torpor, if it does this, then the poor tea is doing the opposite. And I don't really know why. It's either because it's affecting gut bacteria, or because it's a direct inhibitor of the arachidrocarbon receptor, or maybe something else. I don't know. So that's really interesting. But there's a lot of good research on it that it's very good. So that's something that I've been consuming, and I take the extract as well. But then I'm focusing really on things that help with that NADH to NAD plus level. And so what are those things? I've been taking, there's something called alpha lipoic acid, which is very potent, and you can, there's this great paper where they took, it's in rodents, right? But it was like three different ways of fattening up rodents, right? There's like diet-induced obesity, and then there's this other one where they give them like a streptozycin, and they give them these drugs, and that gives them diabetes. And then there's also ones that don't have any leptin receptor, and those are obese. And in all three of those models, so what alpha lipoic acid does is, so we make alpha lipoic acid. It's a cofactor in several of our enzymes. But the way that it's consumed is in the oxidized form. And so it's actually an oxidant. It's sort of if you read the literature, they'll call it an antioxidant, but it's actually the opposite of an antioxidant. And so it oxidizes NADH back to NAD plus. And so it just gives you that NAD plus back. And in all three of those mouse models, you know, it has dramatic success at eliminating the obesity, because much of the obesity is just simply caused by the NADH and NAD plus getting out of whack, in my opinion. But I've also been looking at specific, I want to say parts of the TCA cycle. That's not quite true. You know, supplemental pyruvate is very interesting because, well, pyruvate is lacking. So when the glucose comes in and goes through glycolysis, it actually gives off some NADH, and so it gives off some electrons before it becomes pyruvate to go into the mitochondria. And pyruvate in your blood, so there's this enzyme that can convert pyruvate back to lactate. And what it does is it takes an NADH, it takes the electrons from the NADH, and it sticks them onto the pyruvate, and it becomes lactate. And so the pyruvate is sort of becomes an offloading molecule for NADH, essentially. And so this pyruvate, if you take some pyruvate, your body will offload a bunch of its NADH and convert it back to NAD plus. And then a bunch of the pyruvate will become lactate, but probably not as high of a lactate to pyruvate ratio as you had before. And interestingly, if you look in the blood at the ratio of lactate and pyruvate in the blood, it actually matches the ratio of NADH and NAD plus in your cytoplasm, because pyruvate and lactate are rapidly taken into cells, and then lactate dehydrogenase is an enzyme that works in both directions. So if you have a lot of lactate, it will make NADH, and if you have a lot of pyruvate, it'll make NAD plus, and then they just get re-exported. So the pyruvate and lactate are this kind of medium that connects all of the cells, and it kind of connects the like redox balance of the whole organism through this lactate and pyruvate and lactate dehydrogenase enzyme and these transporters that are constantly taking them in and out. And so pyruvate is this really powerful thing in terms of, you know, lowering that redox balance. And so what I noticed with pyruvate, which is kind of amazing, is if I take enough, there was this weight loss study done in the 80s where they were taking 6 grams of pyruvate, maybe 12, I think they were taking 12 grams a day, which is a lot, right? It's a lot of pyruvate. And they had this pretty dramatic weight loss success in a very short-term trial, and there weren't a lot of people in it. And, but the paper is funny to read because it the language is not like most scientific journals. They're like, the most amazing thing about this paper is like when we had all the people in at the end, like all of their family and friends came with them, and they wanted to know how to get this pyruvate. And so pyruvate had become this kind of trendy weight loss thing around the late 90s. And then some guy kind of I think he was an ex NFL player or something, and he did all these infomercials about pyruvate, and he said all this stuff that wasn't really true. And he made it out to be a lot more than it was, and he got in trouble. And anyway, and so I think a lot of people sort of threw out the baby with the bathwater and said, well, this pyruvate is a bunch of hooey, but it's not. I think the pyruvate is actually, it's a useful tool, right? It's one tool that we have that I think is, anyway, what I was going to say about it is if I take a couple of grams of pyruvate and then I eat like a starchy meal, my body temperature will rise. Like I've measured, if I eat enough pyruvate and then a big starchy meal, I've sometimes measured my body temperature like 99.1 an hour or two after the meal. Like it'll easily go up to 98.8, 98.9. And yeah, sometimes even higher. And so that's an indication to me that, okay, the pyruvate really is, causing my pyruvate dehydrogenase to work. And I think I'm actually burning some of this starch. I'm not just, you know, converting it all to fat, which is, I think, what I used to do and probably still do a lot of the time.
And do you have a sense that if your metabolism's broken, that taking pyruvate or you know, eating in a way that encourages a better pyruvate lactate ratio, that you are fixing your metabolism, or by doing so, are you just acting in a way that your broken metabolism works as best it can?
Well, I think it's, I mean, I think it's the second. I think, you know, I'm not right. I'm not going to fix my metabolism in one day. But I think that, you know, over time, I'm hoping to get, you know, these things take time. And like one of the problems that we have in obesity is that our stored fat actually becomes very high in monounsaturated fats. And so in our stored fat, we've converted a lot of our stearic acid to oleic acid. And so, like I say, that oleic acid, when it burns, doesn't generate the same kind of superoxide, and it doesn't generate as much NAD plus ultimately as if I had stored saturated fat. And so, you know, I have this whole overhanging cliff of monounsaturated fat that I have stored in my body that I'm kind of working against, right? But my thought is that if I continue to use things like pyruvate and alpha lipoic acid, the disadvantage of alpha lipoic acid, by the way, while I'm thinking about it, is it tends to give people like kind of like a brain fog kind of condition if you take too much of it. And so I'm actually, anyway, there's an R lipoic acid, which is the type that is specific to the mitochondria. And I've heard anecdotally people have tried the R lipoic acid, have had better luck with some of these symptoms than just regular alpha lipoic acid. Side note, but an important one. So I've just ordered some of the R lipoic acid. And so I'm hoping that with the lipoic acid and with this things like pyruvate, I can start to burn more of these carbs. And that what that does is it, by changing that NAD plus NADH ratio, my body starts making less of like the SCD1, which is the enzyme that's converting all my stearic acid to oleic acid in the first place. And if I'm burning cleanly, then I'll burn some of that fat. And, you know, so I think that over a period of months, you know, we can reset some of those things, right? Like I'm not going to be fixed overnight. But I think, you know, taking it one meal at a time is helpful. And then the last thing that I've been experimenting with is, succinate. So succinate is very fun. So the reason so in the Krebs cycle, we have, a thing called complex two, which is part of our electron transport chain in the mitochondria where we make ATP. It's also called succinate dehydrogenase. And the problem, the reason that unsaturated fats don't make as much superoxide and don't regenerate the NAD plus is that they don't have as much succinate dehydrogenase activity. They don't have as much activity at complex two, which is an FAD input to the electron transport chain rather than the normal NAD input. If you can, when you look at obese humans, when you look at hibernating animals, one of the first things they downregulate when a hibernating animal wants to lower its metabolic rate, one of the first things it does is it downregulates. Well, there's two things. It downregulates complex two and it turns off pyruvate dehydrogenase, right? And so these are the two in the hot blooded clean burning animal, you're burning carbs at or you're sending your carbs through pyruvate dehydrogenase, and your fat is producing a lot of activity at complex two, which is succinate dehydrogenase. And so another thing I've been selling is this. I just got these disodium succinate capsules, and so that will. And succinate is preferred by brown fat. This is something that hibernators, when they're hibernating, what happens is their complex two, which is where they convert the succinate, gets acetylated, it gets turned off, And succinate kind of builds up because it's a, you know, it's a block in their metabolic cycle. And so they've slowed their metabolism down and the succinate is coming around and it's getting diverted. And brown fat takes that up and it stores it. And then they have to wake up. And so what happens is they send a lot of succinate into the brown fat. The brown fat burns all this succinate, and this generates a tremendous amount of superoxide at complex two, which regenerates NAD plus. And that's how they actually wake up from out of torpor. And that, so they have to have this very rapid metabolic surge. And a lot of that is done by burning succinate. And so the idea of the succinate really is just to replace what is lost at complex two when we're, because of our stored unsaturated fats, and or if we're still continuing to consume unsaturated fats, the succinate will help with that lack of complex two activity. But the other thing that's been shown in mice trials, we also have a succinate receptor on our skeletal muscle. And the succinate seems to, the succinate receptor seems to convert our skeletal muscle into a very oxidative form of skeletal muscle, that the skeletal muscle is actually kind of the preferred type. So in obesity, and I forget the exact, I think we have a lot of type 2B muscle fibers. I forget them, but we do a lot of glycolytic, obese humans do a lot of glycolytic things with their muscles, and they're making a lot of, they're doing a lot of glycolysis and getting energy that way. And they can't necessarily burn, the glucose all the way to generate power in their muscles. And the succinate reverts that and kind of can help your muscles get back to those of a lean human, actually.
Another way it sounds like it's reversing hibernation, reversing torpor.
Right. Well, and that may be, and it may be tied in with exactly that, because one of the things that that is, people wonder about hibernating animals is, so in a human, if you lay in a hospital bed for 6 months, you have all this muscle atrophy. The hibernating animals don't have this, right? The hibernating animals in the spring, they preserve almost all their muscle mass. And so people are like, well, how do they do this? And one of the way might be that since they're not burning the succinate, and they're essentially storing the succinate to get as their fuel to get through winter, those succinate receptors might be saying like, oh, we're not in a hospital bed, we're just hibernating, so we should preserve our muscle mass. And that may be that probably is why that mechanism is there. I would think. And so it all seems to work together. But the trials in rodents using succinate for like weight loss, exercise performance, you know, strength, endurance, NAD plus levels are nothing short of amazing. And so that's why I'm very interested in succinate as another supplement. And so really all those things though, you know, succinate, pyruvate, and alpha lipoic acid are just ways of keeping our NAD pool oxidized and keeping in that burning mode rather than, you know, once we have too much NADH and that pool gets too reduced, that puts us back into kind of fat storing mode again, which is where most of us probably spend much of our lives. And so, yeah, these are kind of simple, safe things, that tools that we can use to kind of lever. And so, yeah.
Sorry. That's brilliant. I feel like, you know, with the hope that's going around with metabolic therapies for mental health and for losing weight, that it's kind of exciting to think about delving a bit further and really understanding what the mechanisms are, because it means you can experiment a little bit further, you know, with supplements, with dietary tweaks that will tell you more about what the overall mechanism is and where your body is at with it. Because I guess that's the thing that you're talking about, is that you might be one of these lucky people who's still a Yankees fan, but probably given the way the world is, you're in a post Yankees fan phase, and it's about working out how to potentially get back to that, how to wake up from some kind of metabolic slowdown that we all seem to be suffering from. And it's exciting to think that we could understand why it happens and not just experience it, which is good enough in and of itself.
Yeah, I know. I think so. And I think that, yeah. And I think there's a lot of interesting things that we can do out there, and just these simple tweaks. But you're right. If you understand what the goal is, right, it doesn't feel like so much like we're like throwing darts against the wall, you know, anymore. It's like, okay, well, this is part of a generalized strategy. We have this evolutionary basis for why did we get the way that we are now, and therefore what do we do to try to get out of it, right? And realistically, you know, a lot of the science that I'm talking about now it's come out within the last 3 years, right? It's all very recent stuff, these trials with succinate and other things. And so I think it's an exciting time. I think for a long time, you know, there was just so much that we didn't know. And of course, there's still so much that we don't know. But my reading of the literature now seems like we're starting to get a handle on the big picture and how it all kind of fits together. And obviously, some of my ideas, like torpor, are not have not been embraced by the mainstream, we'll say. but you know, it's I think if you really look at the evidence, it gets harder and harder to ignore. And then you can start to build strategies, and there's a lot of other things out there, of course, that might dietary flavones are very interesting. Like we said, metformin is a very interesting thing, and that it lowers some of those pathways. You need a prescription for it here in the US. I don't know if that's true in the UK. But it's been around a long time. It's obviously pretty safe. So that's interesting to try. And, and these dietary flavones are interesting. They are something that, I think people think of them as antioxidants. I don't like antioxidants in general, but the flavones are things that actually can block. So I think in my recent, I have an Obesity Explained series on YouTube, and I talked about how some of the flavones actually block the activity of PARP, which is the thing that breaks your NAD plus down. Because I think it's because they, again, on that 3D shape, they have those ring shapes, and I think they look like NAD enough to kind of block the activity of some of those enzymes that are converting the NAD plus to nicotinamide. And that may have some downside too of interfering with NAD plus metabolism in other ways. That's possible, but you know, it's another interesting tool to kind of think about. Quercetin and myristin and those kinds of things. Just kind of shooting off the top of my head of other ideas.
People might be thinking about sometime in the future we might be able to work out a bit more clearly in advance how stacking these types of supplements in the short, medium, long term might work for an individual, or just general broad guidelines about how people might go about it. But I guess I think that's a hopeful place to stop thinking about how people can, you know, go out, try it. If they want to know more, they can go to your blog, which is brilliant, or your YouTube channel, also brilliant, or follow you on Twitter. And I think I'm right in thinking that it's all the same name. Is that right?
It's all Fire in a Bottle, yeah.
Fire in a Bottle.
Twitter, I think, is Fire_Bottle, but everything else, it's Fire in a Bottle.
Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate you coming on and talking again. It's exciting when someone gets excited about the science.
Yes, well, I am a nerd, so that helps,
Well, from one nerd to another, it's appreciated, and I look forward to hearing the response from the episode.
Excellent. Yeah, that sounds great. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Brad.
Good luck, everyone.